content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Smithsonian. Smithsonian is generously supported by the Kepin family. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. On today's program, we'll start with an article titled "The World's Least Lost Wanderer" by Richard Grant. The expert navigator and best-selling author Tristan Gooley helps millions of followers read nature's clues to find their way back home. I'm standing at an intersection of footpaths in the woods of West Sussex, England, feeling a little uncertain of my bearings. Which one of these five paths lead back to the Land Rover parked, I think, roughly north of here? The summer sun is high and obscured by clouds, so not much help. The wind, which has been blowing intermittently from the northeast all day, providing a reliable navigation guide, has now died away completely, and I have no phone, compass, or GPS. Standing next to me is Tristan Gooley, the Sherlock Holmes of nature, as he's nicknamed in the British media, so I'm in no danger of actually getting lost. This tall, affable, bearded Englishman, 52 years old and wearing a canvas bush hat, is one of the most skilled navigators on the planet. He's a master yachtsman and pilot who has risked his life on long solo adventures using conventional navigation instruments, but his greatest expertise is in natural navigation, the ancient, mostly lost art of finding direction by reading the signs and clues in nature. He has studied the directional techniques of the Tuareg, Bedouin, Dayak, and other indigenous peoples around the earth. He's tested Viking seafaring methods in a small boat in the North Atlantic and has written a series of award-winning and internationally best-selling books about natural navigation, weather, water, and more. His latest, out this fall, is The Hidden Seasons, a calendar of nature's clues. Observing my uncertainty at the intersection, Gooley invites me to look more closely at the trees. An isolated broadleaf tree, he says, will nearly always have more branches and leaves on its south side. Trees in the light harvesting business. And sunlight comes from the south in the northern hemisphere, he explains. Sure enough, looking at a birch tree in a clearing, I can see that one side, presumably the southern, has grown more than the other sides. Then he draws my attention to another clue on the same tree. South-facing branches grow directly toward the sunlight. He says, the branches on the north side can't do that because the rest of the tree is in its way, so they grow more vertically to harvest the light above them. My bearings click back into place. The longer, more horizontal branches point south, which means I must be looking east, and the path turning left is going north to the Land Rover. Gooley tamps down my enthusiasm. An isolated tree is pretty dependable, but you never put all your eggs in one basket, he says. You need 7 or 8 other signs to be sure. The brambles flanking the footpath, for example. On one side, the leaves have a red pigment because they're facing south and receiving more sunlight. On the other side, all the leaves are green. The earthen pathway holds another clue. Its northern side is drier and lighter in color, and its south side damper and darker. Gooley can even find signs in an old puddle. If you've got muddy, opaque water at one end and pale green water at the other, plant matter or algae have been blown there by the prevailing wind. In North America and Britain, the prevailing wind blows from the west or southwest. Having confirmed our directions, we walk on through the woods. He asks me what I see, and I list off birch trees, oaks, hazels, a mature beech tree, flowers with butterflies, brambles, patches of stinging nettles, cumulus clouds in the sky, 2 crows flying overhead. Cooley points out what I missed. Many small birds, partially hidden in foliage, spider webs among the roots of the trees, but only on the east side, where they're sheltered from the prevailing westerly wind. He proceeds through 50 or 60 other directional clues that were completely invisible to me. If he's operating at close to 100% sensory awareness, I'm in the 5% range. Because a song thrush has become accustomed to our presence and is singing unconcerned, Gooley concludes that we're the only people in this stretch of the woods. Then another distant bird issues an alarm call, announcing some new and possibly dangerous intrusion into the woods, and the thrush falls silent. "Someone's coming," Gooley says. A few minutes later, two hikers appear with a jog. Before the invention of compasses and sextants, the body of knowledge that Gooley has gathered into his 9 books and taught in lectures and classes was essential to human survival, an activity and widely familiar to people all over the planet. Today, if you have access to a cell phone and GPS, this knowledge is unnecessary, as people often point out to Gooley. He counters that a knowledge of art, music, history, and literature is also unnecessary, but can greatly enrich one's life. "That's what I'm really offering," he says. "I've got nothing against technology. I think it's amazing. But if you leave your phone at home or in your pocket and start using some of these techniques, you'll have a much richer experience outdoors. Your senses will awaken. Your brain will start solving puzzles, which is something the brain loves to do. And I can confirm that the trees and the woods will never look the same again." Gooley grew up in the south of England. He says he moved around a lot, especially after his parents divorced, and he never developed a real sense of home, often feeling insecure and unmoored. As a teenager, he began hurling himself into ambitious outdoor challenges. He learned how to sail, took flying lessons, and the cockpit of a Piper Warrior PA-28, trekked all over Britain, climbed Mount Kilimanjaro, got horribly lost with a friend for 3 days on an active volcano in Indonesia, all by the time he turned 20 in 1993. His father, a former Special Forces officer in the British Army, ran a travel company called Trail Finders, which made it relatively easy for Tristan to go where he wanted. He got his private pilot's license in his mid-20s and became even more mobile. One day he called a friend and suggested that they fly a small plane from England into the Arctic Circle and back, a trip that pushed him to the very edge of his aviation comfort zone. With another friend, he sailed a boat, flew a plane, and drove a 4x4 vehicle from England to the peak of Jebel Toubkal, the highest mountain in North Africa, all because he wanted to get there without buying a commercial ticket. In 1998, he walked from Glasgow to London, relying only on a paper map, taking 5 weeks to cover more than 350 miles. He funded his adventures by working intermittently for his father's company, with stints as a bartender, a crew worker transporting yachts, and a financial speculator who did well betting against the dot-com bubble in the late 1990s. Restless is the word he uses to describe his younger self. He was also highly ambitious. He told himself that he needed to pick one of the things he loved, trekking, sailing, or flying, and make a career out of it. He asked himself which he loved the most, then realized he wasn't in love with any of them. Perplexed, he asked himself what these pursuits had in common. "There were only a few things, and the biggest of all was navigation," he says. "And the penny dropped. It was shaping journeys that I loved." Whether using conventional or natural navigation, he would devote his life to wayfinding. At 25, he entered a long phase of hard study and practice, reading hundreds of books about exploration and navigation, taking courses, practicing skills, and passing some 30 examinations as a pilot and a yachtsman. He had no specific career path in mind. "I strongly believed that if I could develop a unique skill set, an income and a career would follow," he says. The pinnacle of his ambition in his mid-20s was to fly solo and then sail single-handed across the Atlantic in two separate trips. Only one person, the American tycoon adventurer Steve Fawcett, had successfully completed the solo double transatlantic, as Gooley calls it. If Gooley could pull it off, it would prove to himself and everyone else that he had reached the very highest level of skill, daring, and expertise. It wasn't until 2007, however, by which time he was 34, and he had the money, qualifications, and experience to attempt the crossings. And by then, he had married his high school sweetheart, Sophie, with a young child and a baby at home. Fawcett himself would die in a plane crash that same year, reinforcing the danger of Gooley's undertaking. There were only a few dozen pilots with the skill to take light aircraft on such extended legs. Gooley sought them out for advice. Of the seven he talked to, three had died in crashes by the time he was ready to fly. At dawn on May 24, 2007, wearing a rubber immersion suit in case he crashed into the ocean, Gooley took off solo from Goose Bay, Labrador, in a single-engine Cessna Caravan, an aircraft unfamiliar to him and in no way designed to be flown across the Atlantic. There are two ways to do it, he says. Non-stop, which involves putting a ferry tank of extra fuel in the back and flying in one long hop. It sounds romantic, but from a navigational and challenge point of view, it's a dull way to do it. You're staring at engine dials for hours. I wanted to go with refueling stops in Greenland and Iceland, which is riskier, but much more interesting for a navigator. The most poignant moment on the flight for Gooley was writing down the letters PNR and circling them after he'd passed the point of no return, roughly halfway between Goose Bay and Narsequah in Greenland. However much he wanted to might want to turn back if the weather got hairy, he wouldn't make it because he'd run out of fuel and wind up in the sea. At one point, ice formed on the wings, forcing him to deploy his oxygen mask and to fly above the aircraft's legal limit in order to escape the icing conditions. Very scary times, he recalls. As he descended into Scottish airspace on the morning of the second day, he could hear through his headset, above the din of the engine, an ominous cracking sound. Is the whole airframe about to implode around me as the air pressure increases because of some stupid oversight of mine, he recalls thinking. The sound, it turned out, was the plastic bottle of urine next to him. He had half filled it at 15,000 feet. A challenging maneuver in a rubber immersion suit with no fly and five harness straps, and the bottle was now reacting to the descent into higher air pressure. After refueling in Scotland, Gooley made his final landing in Oxford, England. In December of that year, he attempted the ocean crossing, departing the marina in the Canary Island of Lanzarote in a 32-foot-long fiberglass monohull sailing yacht named Goldeneye that he'd bought for the voyage. The first 2 days were appalling. He had to thread the boat through the chain of Canary Islands via busy shipping lanes, dodging large fishing vessels. Sudden accelerating winds rushed between the volcanic peaks of the Canary Islands and were impossible to anticipate at night. A storm off Madeira produced daunting 20-foot swells. Once he reached the middle of Atlantic, he went for 10 days without seeing, hearing, or sensing any evidence of human beings. It was physically relaxing, but psychologically challenging, he says. He was lonely with no stimuli to change his mood. It was sometimes tedious, and he was always uncomfortably hot. It was also an extended exercise in making important decisions while extremely sleep-deprived. Except once when he missed his alarm and slept for an hour and a half. Gooley didn't sleep for more than 30 minutes at a stretch for the whole 26 days. A romantic highlight was getting smacked in the face by flying fish while he watched dolphins ride his bow wave. He navigated by the sun, the wind, the ocean currents, and the amazing stars at night. And he used navigational instruments to avoid collisions with other vessels. He felt a deep bond with his boat, but during serene moments, his mind erupted with a self-lacerating question. What the hell are you doing out here with a six-month baby at home? Making landfall in St. Lucia on New Year's Day 2008, he met a glorious surprise. Sophie was there on a launch with baby Vincent, four-year-old Ben, and other family members. The bay was full of tooting horns, crowds, dignitaries, and TV cameras, and folks had brought champagne to toast him and a steel band to boot. In a way, it was the grand finale to his life as an international adventurer. He remains the only living person to have flown solo and sailed single-handed across the Atlantic. In 2008, Gooley decided to open a small school to teach the natural navigation techniques he had picked up and developed over the years. He budgeted approximately $2,000 of his savings, spent half of it getting a rudimentary website built, and sent out press releases. I genuinely didn't think it could work, he says. At first, he operated out of a shepherd's hut near his home in West Sussex. Then he was able to rent a heavily discounted room from the Royal Geographical Society, the London-based organization that has promoted geographical knowledge since 1830. Gooley has been a fellow there for more than a decade. The teaching sessions were well attended by members of the public and journalists, as well, first the newspapers, then radio and BBC television, and he's been busy ever since. Many of Gooley's students attest that his teaching has led them to a deeper connection with nature, but in his sales pitch, he steers well clear of anything spiritual, medicinal, or metaphysical. Rather, he emphasizes, natural navigation is about exploration and simple fun. If someone said to me, go spend 20 minutes in a forest and just look at that tree, I'd be thinking, what is the effing point of that? My approach is to help people share the fun of dozens of mini treasure hunts. I say, would you like to learn how to find your way using a butterfly or find north by looking at a tree leaf? In 2010, Gooley published his first book, The Natural Navigator. He was aware that the knowledge he had accumulated and the methods he had cultivated himself might vanish from the earth, and this was one impetus to write them down. He was also evolving from an adventurer into an educator and hoping that others would share his passion for the subject. The book unexpectedly sold out its first printing in days and raced through a second and third, attracting international attention. In all, his books have now sold 1.5 million copies and have been published in 20 languages. How to Read Water, Clues and Patterns from Puddles to the Sea, 2016, shares hundreds of techniques from Gooley's sailing voyages, his canoe trips in Borneo, and his time navigating the Gulf of Oman by starlight. The Secret World of Weather, 2021, based on decades of study and observations of 2 years' intensive research within Britain's meteorological community, helps readers make detailed, highly local weather forecasts by observing nature. Perching birds usually face into the wind because taking off is easier for them that way. If they turn around, a change in the weather is probably approaching. Gliding birds signal stable air and fair weather. Crickets chirp faster as the temperature rises, while snowflakes get smaller as the temperature drops. Gooley's new book, The Hidden Seasons, distills new insights into a month-by-month guide by being more attentive to nature's signs. Gooley has settled into a comfortable, rewarding career of teaching, lecturing, writing, and researching, while making ever more detailed observations of the natural landscape in West Sussex and other parts of Britain. In 2020, the first year of the COVID-19 pandemic, he won praise from the Royal Institute of Navigation for naming a previously uncategorized type of path, the smile path. Gooley describes it as a short, curved detour around an obstacle or problem, such as a muddy area or a fallen tree. During social distancing, he noticed, people moved aside to give other walkers a wider berth, and curving, smile-shaped paths formed alongside the straighter, established pathways in woods and parks. The Royal Institute invited the public to send images of smile paths, offering a year's free membership and six Gooley books for the most interesting ones. Confirmation bias is the constant enemy of the natural navigator. Humans tend to look for signs that support their current theory, or hunch, of direction and ignore those that contradict it. And nature's signs can be deceptive. Back in the woods of West Sussex, we came upon a large isolated beech tree, and Ghouli asks me which direction we're facing. The tree has more growth on what I assume is its south side, but I'm 180 degrees wrong. The tree has more branches and leaves on its north side. I'm willing to bet there was another large tree growing south of this one and blocking its light, Ghouli says. Striding through the bracken and brambles, his pants tucked into his boots to protect against ticks, he finds a large stump to the beach's south. The departed tree inadvertently sculpted the shape of its living neighbor and was now feeding it by decaying into the earth. As a young man, Ghouli would trek at a fast march, covering at least 15 miles a day, even in difficult mountainous terrain. These days, he's incapable of going on a family walk without getting left far behind. He is physically fit, but moves very slowly through the woods because he's forever stopping, examining, noticing new things, anomalies, asymmetries, trying to solve the riddles that nature keeps setting in front of him. He maintains this extraordinary degree of awareness when he's in cities, paying close attention to cloud movements, moss, and lichen growths on buildings, puddle reflections, and the flows of pedestrian traffic at different times of day. Brick chimneys, he's noticed, tend to lean slightly north over time. TV satellites in the northeast United States generally point southwest, and the world's tennis courts are often aligned north to south to minimize the sun's glare. Over a late lunch of sandwiches, strawberries, and strong black coffee from a flask, I ask Ghouli what to do if you get lost in the woods. The biggest challenge is psychological, because you panic and you go into a mental tailspin, he says. The best thing to do is to touch a rock or tree and focus on the temperature differences. The north side will be cooler, the south side warmer. Taking that one small action will tell your panic circuitry that it's not needed. He munches a strawberry and decides to refine his advice. In most situations, you stay put. It's harder to find people who walk in circles, and lost people nearly always walk in circles. Next, we'll move on to an article from The Past is Prologue, discussing an American icon, Brothers in Arms by Michael Callahan, how the high-minded, sleuthing Hardy Boys helped define American boyhood. Edward Stratemeyer had a plan to get American children reading. An ambitious paper merchant in Newark, New Jersey, he founded a publishing company, the Stratemeyer Syndicate, in 1906 with the goal of dominating the emerging juvenile fiction market. The company's success came largely from series books written by an army of ghostwriters spinning wholesome adventure stories under company-owned pseudonyms. Over the next quarter century, the Stratemeyer Syndicate would create some of the most enduring characters in children's literature. Tom Swift, the Bobbsey Twins, whose plucky exploits instilled in young people a love of reading that arguably wouldn't be duplicated until Harry Potter books came out at the end of the century. It was in 1927 that Stratemeyer introduced the characters who would become the company's tentpole, the Hardy Boys, two small-town brothers of impeccable virtue and daring. It would define what it meant to be a 20th century American boy. They would also inspire the creation of their female counterpart, Nancy Drew, introduced just 3 years later. The brothers, Frank 18 and Joe 17, lived in the Atlantic coastal town of Bayport, where they embody the values of self-reliance, hard work, and rigorous honesty. As amateur sleuths, the Hardys traverse gloomy cemeteries and dank caves, forbidding mansions and shadowy hideouts, darting through danger with breezy guile and Boy Scout winsomeness. Their father, Fenton, is a private investigator who encourages his son sleuthing while their doting mother, Laura, worries. She has reason to. The brothers dodge gunshots and elude sinister henchmen and survive myriad assaults, fires, robberies, boat sinkings, plane crashes, and car accidents, sometimes all in the same story. They are kidnapped regularly. In 1976's The Witchmaster's Key, the pair even winded up tied to a medieval rack in the dungeon of an English castle. Yet through cunning observation and gluing through clues, the pair always nab the scoundrels. The brothers' persistent appeal for almost a century comes from their bewitching blend of rectitude and glamour. The original 58 stories, known by devotees as the canon, were conceived and written by the syndicate and then distributed by its publishing partner, Grosset and Dunlap, between 1927 and 1979. All books appeared under the pseudonym Franklin W. Dixon, but the mastermind behind the earliest and most beloved stories was Canadian journalist Leslie MacFarlane. He went a long way towards defining the brothers' gallantry and brio, and the 20 stories he penned from 1927 to 1946. His vivid, galloping tales challenged children with intricate plotting and words such as prosaic and spasmodic. As Marilyn S. Greenwald writes in her 2004 biography of MacFarlane, he respected his adolescent audience and refused to write down to them. Subsequent adventures, written by others under the same pseudonym, devolved into the kind of prose found in better comic books. After Stratemeyer died in 1930 at 67, his two daughters, Harriet Adams and Edmund Squire, took over, issuing detailed plot outlines as the writers churned out story after story. And the sisters were as zealous as their father had been in projecting boys as trustworthy and honorable. In the revised 1959 version of The House on the Cliff, Fenton gravely warns his sons, "So often when a young man joins a group of hoodlums or racketeers, he's blackmailed for the rest of his life. The best way to avoid such a situation is never to get into it." Gregarious, confident, and steely, Adams was a Wellesley graduate and mother of four who quickly took on the role of leading the syndicate, becoming a pioneering businesswoman. "My grandmother did not consider herself a feminist," says her granddaughter, Kimberly Stratemeyer Adams, "but she strongly felt women were equal to men in what they could achieve and felt they should set their goals and go after them." Responding to parental complaints, Grosset and Dunlap heavily revised the original books in 1959 to scrub dated language and to remedy ethnic and racist stereotypes. Oddly, the constant fat-shaming of the brothers' chum Chet Morton survived. The Hardy Boys went on to headline several television adaptations, most notably of the late 1970s ABC series that made teen idols of Parker Stevenson and Shaw and Cassidy. 2 years after Adams' death in 1982, her heirs sold the syndicate to Simon & Schuster, which eventually released more than 300 additional titles, including several noirish spin-offs. Long before gritty reboots became common, the Hardy Boys tilled the terrain through new books series that reimagined them as hip heroes tackling far more sinister missions. Whether in the famous Blue Spine volumes read by every boomer boy or their more recent, more hard-boiled conceptions, the Hardy Boys continue, a century later, to embody the qualities that men once wished for ourselves and still wish for our sons and grandsons. As Greenwald writes, "Boys who grow up to succeed in a variety of careers, including as writers and English professors, are happy to admit that these were the books that first got them hooked on reading." We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian, generously underwritten by the Kepin family. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.